Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Paul Eli, author of Reinventing Bach, and Andre Cadrescu, whose two new books are So Recently Rent a World and Bibliodeath, My Archives, with Life in Footnotes. My guest today is Paul Eli, the author of Reinventing Bach. This is a wonderful book about the enduring power of one man's music and the devotees who have brought that music to life again and again. It's also the story of the twinned evolution of music and technology. For a long time, Bach's music was only heard in churches, and now he's everywhere. As Paul writes, he's in my back pocket. Welcome to The Reading Life, Paul.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I love this book. It also reminds me of your last book, The Life You Save May Be Your Own, about Thomas Merton, Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor, and Dorothy Day. There's so much about the life of the spirit in Reinventing Bach. It's so much about devotion to art, don't you think?
That's definitely the way I felt writing it, like a devotee. I like the word you used back there. And that's the way I felt writing about O'Connor, Merton, Percy, and Dorothy Day also. Certainly, you feel as a writer an obligation to do justice to these figures, not to be merely a devotee. I had to make them live on the page. In the case of Bach, I had to find a way to make his music live on the page through my words. But I was a devotee or revenant for 1001 nights with headphones on, hands at the keyboard, playing my instrument, a laptop, in homage to Bach.
I love that story about your train trip to Durham, North Carolina from New York. Tell us about that.
I was working at a couple of magazines and just patching together a living, and I got a magazine assignment to interview the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre in North Carolina. I was a late comer to the CD format, but before that long trip, the night before, I went to HMV record store here in Manhattan and bought a CD player and a couple of CDs. One was B.B. King's Live at the Regal, and the other was the three-disc St. Matthew Passion. It was Holy Week, so the next morning I got on the train in New York and put on the St. Matthew Passion and just listened and read that little booklet with the words in four languages, you know, probably all the way down to Washington, D.C., and then started over again and heard the Passion a second time as the train pushed further into the South. And I could just feel the music taking me somewhere just as the train was taking me somewhere, and I could feel myself really being changed by that music. And I turned off the CD player at the end, and that Passion was in my head for the rest of my time in North Carolina, and I've never forgotten it.
That's a wonderful thing when the literal journey and the spiritual journey come together, isn't it?
It is, and the stereotype about the St. Matthew Passion is that it's very long and very stately, and different musicians have dealt with that in different ways. There's a conductor named Otto von Klemperer who exaggerated the stateliness of it, stretched out every figure. And there's several conductors now who've done very brisk versions, trying to make it as light and fleet as possible. But in my case, listening to the recording that I'd bought, I could feel the pull of the music. I could feel the narrative shape of that work in a way that I don't think I would have felt if I'd been sitting in my apartment listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you talk about that's so fascinating is the devotion that musicians have brought to this work and how many people in so many ways went to school learning the works of Bach. Albert Schweitzer, Pablo Casals, Glenn Gould, Yo-Yo Ma. Those are incredibly charismatic and interesting figures. What was that like for you to explore their lives and their devotion?
Well, let me talk a little about how the book compares to my first book as a way of answering the question. My first book was about four writers, and I figured out a couple of wonderful things writing that book. One is that it was really refreshing to have four protagonists. I could spend a couple of weeks with Flannery O'Connor and then put away all the O'Connor books and take out the Dorothy Day books and spend a week with her. And then take out the Percy books and spend a week with him. The other thing I discovered is that when you're writing a book about extraordinary writers, if you quote them in the right ways, your own work is just buoyed up by the quality of their prose. So then it comes time to write a book about Bach and his interpreters, his devotees. I had that same experience of being in the company of different great artists at different points, that I would spend some time with Pablo Casals, and then I'd be switching over to Leopold Stokowski, or I'd write about Stokowski for a couple of weeks and then really dig into Glenn Gould. So in that respect, it was very similar to the life you say maybe your own. But when it came to the music, suddenly I was in a position where I didn't have text to quote in the same way. I had to make the music represent the music not by quotation, but by finding words for the music in my book. And I tried to do that as many different ways as possible so that you don't feel, okay, take a time out now, he's describing one of the works, the way you sometimes feel reading books about music. I thought if I can describe the music as many different ways as possible, it'll fit right into the story.
I thought those were some of the loveliest parts of the book, those descriptions of the music.
I'm flattered that you say so, and one of the reviews of the book was by the chief music critic for the New York Times, and he said that I know how to write about music, and I thought, well, I'll take it. Somebody who does that for a living at that level likes the music passage of the book, then I can die happy, I guess.
Oh, I hope so. Now, one of the things that's so interesting about this book is that you're writing so much about a spiritual dimension of technology and how the way technological innovations have brought Bach's music to new and different audiences. And so I wonder if you'd kind of talk about some of those things.
Well, you already asked me about a very powerful experience I had that was delivered by a compact disc player. And that was my experience again and again during the years in which I figured out that I was going to write this book. I've had some extraordinary experiences at concerts. The live St. Matthew Passion literally knocked depression out of me one winter. I went in a low state to that performance and came away from it fully alive and didn't have to look back for a long time. There were plenty of experiences like that. But again and again, I would have these really powerful experiences with the music of Bach through recordings. And then I'd turn to books about music, and the recording would always be either not mentioned at all or mentioned as this diminished thing, a pale approximation of the experience of hearing the music live. And writing The Life You Saved Might Be Your Own, my first book, I came to really value the role of experience. So in this case, I trusted my experience of the music, which is that there's this kind of transcendence to be found through our experience in recordings. We get to hear the music over and over again if we want. We get to hear lots of different versions if we want. We get to hear it when we're most ready to hear it and not, you know, from 8 to 11 on concert night. We get to stop when we're tired and pick up again when we have energy. We get to hear it while we're moving, which can bring out some of the kinetic qualities of the music, and so on and so forth. So this instinctive love of the recorded experience led me to try to explain how it works and how it has a transcendent character.
Now, at the end of the book, well, all through it, but really there's this wonderful concentrated section at the end where you have a wonderful section about your own personal love and experience of this music, especially Bachfest. And I wonder if you're deep into Bachfest now this year.
The Bachfest is an annual week or 10 days of Bach played on the Columbia University radio station. Going on since the 80s, I think. I started listening in about 1988 and trying not to miss it any year. And it really communicates the feeling of an old-fashioned festival. I mean, you in New Orleans know what a real festival is and how the certain feast days can overtake large parts of the city. But for me, to hear that Bach Fest is to feel what it must have been like in Leipzig around Christmas time, where this music is just everywhere. So essentially, that was like a great master class in Bach, to hear a week of his music every year while I was in graduate school. And now I have the good fortune of appearing on the festival as a guest on Monday, Christmas Eve. So after 30 years of self-tutored experience in Bach through the Bach Fest, I'll be on behind the microphone. I can't wait.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, the new year is traditionally a time of new beginnings. And at the end of the book, you made a resolution to listen to a Bach prelude every day. And I wonder if you've kept that resolution.
I didn't.
Well, okay, I'll let you off the hook, Paul.
Well, I was finishing the book, and I made this resolution to listen to a Bach prelude and fugue every day because I could do that on an iPod. load it up with lots of preludes and fugues and have a month's worth without having to reload. But I was finishing the book, and the last quarter of the book, I try to capture all sorts of diverse experiences with the music of Bach, looking at graphic representations of Bach on YouTube, going to hear very unusual live works based on Bach, looking at old movies with Bach in it. So after years and years of very focused listening, suddenly I was set free to just find Bach here, there, and everywhere, and that's what I did instead of listening to the Prelude and Fugue.
Well, you found a lot of it in rock and roll, too, which I found charming.
That's right. I mean, the principle I had in writing the book was to not say that things sounded like Bach in general, that I wanted to find instances of the actual music of Bach in many places in the culture. So I really felt that I'd struck gold the day I read that John Lennon, when he was recording In My Life with the Beatles, told the producer George Martin, "Look, George, we're going to go out for a smoke. For the middle eight, can you come up with something Bach-like?" And Martin played a very slow figure on the piano with the tape running at half speed, reel-to-reel tape. Then he doubled the tape speed, which doubled the tempo of the little figure that he just played and brought the pitch up higher, making it sound thin and twinkly like a harpsichord. And there was the Bach figure that John Lennon had asked for, and it's there on right in the middle of In My Life by the Beatles.
Oh, I love that story. Now, I wonder if you could extrapolate a bit about books and reading from the experience of writing this book. I mean, Bach has endured from those early performances in person and churches through the years to the recording, the cassette tape, the CD, the digital recording, and onward. Do you think there's a lesson for us about books and reading in this as well?
Very definitely. I think of what's happened in recorded music over the past 75 years is, let's say it's a kind of past as prologue to what's happening in books as digitization happens. In the 30s, recordings had been around for years and years, but suddenly they were ubiquitous. The price of a phonograph fell, radio was widespread enough that you could count on hearing it just about anywhere, and there were lots of different programs. And there's something similar that's happened with books in the last 10 years. Computers were around for years and years, digital texts were around and around, but suddenly the formats are easy and convenient, the prices drop, the number of texts that are available for, say, an e-reader, you know, is very large, and suddenly anyone who wants one can figure out a way to get one. So we're used to thinking as book people, well, that's the end. But to look at what's happened in recorded music is, 75 years after 1935, we're a golden age where live music thrived, recorded music thrived in three or four formats. Nobody could imagine wanting to be without all the great music just of Bach that was made between 1935 and, let's say, 2010. People found ways to get the old effects that everybody loved and to do them in different formats, and I think that's what's going to happen with the book.
I hope you're right. I have to say, I love this book because it made me rush out to listen to Bach. It made me want to hear all the things you were writing about, even if they were familiar, and it made me seek out new music that I probably hadn't listened to, although really, new Bach. That's sort of what you're talking about. Oh, well, thank you so, so much, Paul. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure, and enjoy your listening.
I will. Happy New Year, Paul.
And to you. Thank you.
Andrei Kudrescu is the author of, oh, so many books, collections of poetry, essays. He's written beautifully about New Orleans for more than 20 years, novels, autobiographies. He's edited anthologies as well as the print, then online journal, Exquisite Corpse. He taught at Louisiana State University for 25 years. His voice, that beloved and quirky Romanian-accented voice, is familiar to all of us from his astringent and often charming commentary on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Today, we're talking about two new books, So Recently Rent a World, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 2012, as well as Bibliodeath, My Archives, with Life in Footnotes. Andre, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Now, you're speaking to us from your home in the Arkansas Ozarks. So how's retirement treating you?
Well, I have two caves, a spring cave and a midnight cave. The spring cave has a spring that bubbles right in the middle of it, and my friends and I can sit on these two limestone ledges and philosophize if we feel like it. And I have a big open-air studio to work with roots and fallen trees and things and make stuff I hate to call art, but it's fun. I like it.
What's a midnight cave?
The midnight cave I've only been in twice because it is so deeply dark and there are bats in it, and so I didn't want to disturb them. But it has two chambers, and you go a little bit on your belly, and when you get in, you stand up, and you stand inside the most velvety darkness possible.
Wow. All right. Be careful. That's all I can think to say. Now, if these two books are any indication, your retirement is going to be plenty busy. I loved looking at So Recently Rent a World. There are so many new poems here, as well as such a generous selection from previous volumes. And you're looking at more than 40 years of work. So what was that process like for you to go back to the beginning and pick and choose and think about what you liked the most?
It was hard because I hate rereading myself, and I didn't really want to go over old ground, but, you know, I became curious, and I reread some of the books, and then I had the good help of my editor at Coffee House Press, Alan Kornblum, who has been a long-time reader, and he knows my poems maybe better than I do, and he helped me, and then I added the new poems, and the book makes an interesting arc from my first poems in English in 1968 to my new work. And, you know, in some ways, actually, I've managed to stay consistent, if not in my themes, but in my syntax and my accent and my preoccupations. You know? So, I mean, yeah, it makes a kind of sense.
And your voice.
It makes sense to be a poet, actually. In the end, you know, I was reading it and thinking, well, you know what? It's our worst way of spending 40 years, maybe at the desk or something, you know.
Now, the new poems to me seem to focus in some ways on divisions and tears in our collective fabric. And some of them have a kind of anguish, but there's also that kind of typical humor of yours. I think of that poem, The Gap, and that wonderful poem, Life Haikus.
I guess. You know, the newer works are more direct, and I didn't resort to a bunch of poetic tricks like metaphors and vague poetic, quote-unquote, devices. You know, I just wrote without ornaments. And so I think those poems are more direct, more urgent somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I especially loved Life Haikus. I loved the forms I should have never practiced. The American novel, the benefit reading, day trading, things I regret not doing, speaking with Lemon on the swing, being nicer to bad poets, selling in 1999, and things I couldn't do. Be nice to bad poets, ask rich people for money, use my magazine to get gigs. That's a real summation there, Andre, I have to say.
Since retiring from LSU, I felt pretty free to write whatever I wanted to. I mean, I wasn't really aware of many constraints before, but then when I really didn't have any, I sort of found that there were invisible things, and so I just let myself go, and I didn't care about the form so much. I wanted to make things that talked about everything, and I let my unconscious interrupt me. I wrote a good line, and I would just, and then I would think something else. I would let that come to the surface and just break through there and give the work less typography.
Mm-hmm. And BiblioDeaf, let's talk about that. What an unusual and wonderful memoir. I seem to know many writers right now who are gathering up their papers and going through their life's work and finding homes for its future. Tell us about the origin of this book.
Well, the Elaine Smith, the director at the LSU Hill Memorial Library, which is a rare books library, asked me to write an essay about the books and manuscripts I donated to them before I retired. And I started writing this essay about my relationship with the archive, you know, my thoughts about giving away my manuscripts and all that. And then it became, I realized that I was holding in my hand something much bigger than just an essay about giving my books and manuscripts to the archive, because archives are a philosophical subject and a very important one right now. I think that the second best known in the English language after Google is archives.
Mm-hmm.
So, every time you open your email, it says archives. So then I thought, you know, it's, I wonder, you know, what happens to the libraries and the collections that are archiving, digitizing frantically all their archives. And it set me on this memoir, really, of the changes in writing technologies that happened all in my lifetime. And so I went back to my first notebook, which was a handwritten notebook, a teenager in Romania in the mid-60s. And the momentous event of the typewriter, which, you know, changed almost everything in many ways. And then, you know, printing, of course, in the book, and the kinds of printing we were doing at a certain point, and then suddenly advent of the internet and electronic publishing, and all of this happened very fast. And I realized that there was something profound changing, not just for writers and for myself, but in human archiving, in the archiving of how humans know things and how they access them. And so it became complicated. I read things that I had read before, but some that I hadn't, like Foucault's Archaeology of Knowledge and Derrida's book, The Archival Fever, mm-hmm. which is a book about the house of Sigmund Freud in London becoming a museum, and all sorts of things I had to do as archives. And I realized that there was a big literature concerned with knowledge and how we preserve it and how we transmit it. And this is an ongoing question for librarians, for archivists, and, you know, so I wrote my own history of living through all these technologies and what the archives are, the memories. In footnotes, it envelops this essay.
One of the great ideas that you put out there that kind of consoled me and charmed me at the same time was that idea that no archive is ever complete. And, you know, in your own life, there's that tantalizing missing notebook of yours, that first notebook, and then there's another notebook that you lost that was very important to you and came back to you. And I love that you grew up in a town that housed one of the oldest printing guilds in Europe, and you've come from that through everything. You know, you've gone all the way from that to online journals, from beautiful small press books, commercially published books, chapbooks, that kind of radio writing that goes out into the world, and even memory sticks, which you certainly appreciate as a metaphor. You've seen your words take so many forms, and then there's that dispersed archive of books that you lend to your friends.
Well, these are books. I mean, I continued lending books because I only lend books that I like, and so I have to get new copies, and this is a dispersed archive that of books that are never returned by the people I gave them to, which either proves that I had good sense about what they were or that my friends are no good.
And I love the way you describe libraries in this book. I love the way you say they have an erotic charge.
Well, they do. That comes from my adolescence. So I think I was too shy to actually talk to girls, but I fantasized about them. And I liked girls' glasses, read books. And the best place to see them were in libraries, and so there was always this sort of a slight connection between flesh and intelligence and libraries for me.
Absolutely. I love that moment you describe of pulling a book off the shelf and seeing a pair of eyes looking through the other side.
Well, yeah, that's a cinematic moment, but I'm not sure it's ever happened. It's certainly a good fantasy.
Well, it's been so much fun to read this book. I love the way you describe crossing that border between the real and the virtual in your lifetime. And it's just pure pleasure, Andre, as always.
Well, Susan, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And, you know, you're really the light of books in New Orleans, because I don't think the town would be educated if it wasn't for you.
Oh, well, we've been speaking with Andre Kudrescu, whose two new books are So Recently Rent a World, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 2012, and Bibliodeath, My Archives, with Life in Footnotes. Andre, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much. Happy birthday and Happy New Year.
Well, thank you for both, and I hope you have a great, peaceful and creative and inspired New Year.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Christy Hemingway signs The Thinking Beekeeper, Wednesday, January 2nd at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library. She appears again Thursday, January 3rd at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Emily Epstein Landau signs Spectacular Wickedness, Sex, Race, and Memory in Storyville, New Orleans, Thursday, January 3rd at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, January 7th at 6 p.m. at the Newcomb College Center for Research on Women. Archivist Susan Tucker will talk about what goes into a literary archive and how to preserve your own. The Black Widow Salon features guests Pandora Gastelum and Ratty Skirvix discussing fairy tales and more upstairs at Crescent City Books, Monday, January 7th from 7 to 9. Looking for a good cause to support in 2013? Think about literacy. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, begins a new training for volunteers Tuesday, January 8th from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. at St. Augustine's Episcopal Church, 3412 Herring Road in Metairie. There are other training sessions throughout the month. Call 899-0820 for info or check out starenola.org. Or you could check out ymcaneworleans.org to get involved with the programs of YMCA Educational Services working in adult literacy. One of the pleasures of 2012 has been seeing the return of so many branch libraries in Orleans and Jefferson Parishes. Friends of both libraries can use help working on their book sales. You'll meet wonderful, literate people, and you'll get a first look at those donations, too. Check out fnopl.org or friendsofjeffersonlibrary.org. Coming up in March is the 27th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. To volunteer for that wonderful weekend, check out tennesseewilliams.net. Or think about joining a book group. Almost every bookstore has one. Kick up your reading life a notch. And we hope you'll tell us about your reading life in the coming year. You can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. And thanks for another wonderful year. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.